Do you swear on the Constitution of the United States to tell the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
This is Police Radio,
the voice of American law enforcement,
with your host, Randy Sutton.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network. I'm your host, Randy Sutton. Thank you so much for joining me. Got a great show for you today. Got a fantastic guest interview. And it's very timely. This interview that you're going to hear was taped earlier, reference to Heather McDonald's book called The War on Cops. And this interview is very timely because of what just took place to Heather McDonald. So let's take a walk into the briefing room where I'm going to give you my view from the blue.
The Briefing Room. Headlines, stories, and all that touches American law enforcement.
First of all, Heather McDonald is one of the premier journalists in America. She is an author, and she wrote a number of books, but the one we're going to talk about today is called The War on Cops: How the New Attack on Law and Order Makes Everyone Less Safe. Heather is not only a journalist, but she's a researcher who is impeccable. Her book, The War on Cops, talks in great detail, statistically and anecdotally, about the war on cops and the Black Lives Matter movement. And it's very eye-opening. I would suggest anyone that has interest in this topic pick it up. What happened to her last week is what I want to address. She is someone who is very opinionated. She knows from whence she speaks, and she was invited to speak to a couple college campuses in California. Now, we all know what's been taking place at some of these universities. If you don't agree with the, quote, social justice warriors, unquote, the students that don't like your opinion, these people have been shutting down anyone that they don't like to hear speak. And the university campuses have just been basically throwing up their hands and allowing anarchists and these, quote, students, unquote, who want to shut down free speech. And they did it again. They did it with Heather. So Heather was invited to speak to two colleges. One was the Claremont McKenna College in Claremont, California, and the other was at UCLA. Now, it's almost mind-boggling what's taking place on some of these campuses. She was an invited guest. When she was arriving at the campus, she basically had to go under lockdown, and they had to hide her away and then sneak her into where she was supposed to be speaking. There's insanity here. So let me read something from what she wrote about her experience. Okay, a Facebook post came out when she was announced that she was going to be speaking. And it says, "We, students of color at the Claremont Colleges, announced grandiosely that, quote, as a community, we cannot and will not allow fascism to have a platform. We will stand against all forms of oppression, and we refuse to have McDonald speak." A Facebook event titled "Shut Down Anti-Black Fascist Heather McDonald" and hosted by "Shut Down Anti-Black Fascists" encouraged students to protest the event because Heather McDonald condemns the Black Lives Matter movement. Well, oh my goodness gracious. The snowflakes on the campus lost their minds because, God forbid, somebody has a different opinion than them. Now, she, when I say she, Heather had to be guarded by the police and brought, this is at the Claremont College, and she was brought into an area where she had to be protected. Before the event could get going, there were campus police officers that had been brought in. Claremont City police officers had been brought in, but they didn't do anything to allow her to speak. They basically, once again, a university allowed an invited guest to be shut down. What she wound up doing was doing a live event to an empty room over the internet. That's what she wound up doing because of the protesters outside. The faculty, the administration, and the police did nothing to afford her right to free speech. Now, I don't know about you, but that scares me. That frightens me, because that is exactly what happened in the 1930s when Nazi Germany began its ascent, and Adolf Hitler wanted to shut down any other viewpoints other than his own. Now, this is from Heather's report about what took place. I'm going to read it to you because it's really important what she said. "Hyperbole is part and parcel of political speech, but I would hope that there are some remaining faculty with enough of a lingering connection to reality who would realize that I and other conservatives are not a literal threat to minority students. To try to prevent me or other dissenting intellectuals from connecting with students is simply an effort to maintain the left's monopoly of thought. The fact that this suppression goes under the title of, quote, anti-fascism is particularly rich. I'm reluctant to wield the epithet fascist as promiscuously as my declared opponents do. But I must be observed that if campus conservatives tried to use physical force to block Senator Elizabeth Warren, say, from giving a speech, the New York Times would likely put the obstruction on the front page and the phrase fascist would be flying around like a swarm of hornets, followed immediately by the epithet misogynist. And when students and their fellow anarchists start breaking glass, destroying businesses, assaulting perceived opponents as they did during the Milo riots and in Middlebury College, it is hard not to hear the echoes of 1930s fascism." And then she went on to say, "The students currently stewing in delusional resentments and self-pity will eventually graduate. Some will seize levers of power more far-reaching than those they currently wield over toadying campus bureaucrats and spineless faculty. Unless the campus zest for censorship is combated now, what we have always regarded as a precious inheritance could be eroded beyond recognition, and a soft totalitarianism could become the new American norm." This is what is frightening to me. This is what is frightening in America, that students and faculty have teamed together to shut off the right to free speech. And law enforcement is being used by these campus administrations to, instead of enforcing the constitutional rights that these speakers have, they're being used to shut them down. This is frightening on a number of different levels. And what is happening in reality is that these administrations of these colleges are hiring spineless police chiefs that will do their bidding, as we saw in Berkeley, which is the perfect example, when Heather referred to Milo Yiannopoulos tried to speak there. And the police officers were ordered to stand down even while people were being beaten. Now, this is another example of just that. Free speech is the constitutional right of every American. And when I took the oath and I put on that badge and I swore to God that I would protect the constitutional rights of the citizens that I served, there is no way in the world that I would allow people to shut down the free speech of these people, of Heather McDonald's, of the Milo Yiannopoulos's of the world. This is the very fabric of what this nation stands for. And unless not only the administrators on these campuses, but the law enforcement administrators and leaders have the guts to stand up for what's right. We're going to continue to shut down free speech. We're going to continue to allow anarchists and leftists to control our campuses, and we are going to expand the thought processes in a negative way of our students. And that's going to have far-reaching effects all over the country when it comes down to civil unrest and who's going to be on the front line. It's going to be the American law enforcement officer. They're going to be the ones that are catching the rocks and the bottles and the assaults. We have to stand up now, and we have to stand together against this threat. And that's my first part of my view from the blue for today. But I'm not done, ladies and gentlemen. I am not done by a long shot. If you have any security needs, no matter what state you're in, the company to call is JSD Protective Services. I've been really impressed with this company. I've met several of the people who are involved in it, and they are quintessential security officers. They really care about what they're doing. This company does everything you could want when it comes to security. They do courier service. They do armed security. They actually do police functions as well with certain contracts that they have. They are private detectives. They have pretty much everything that you could want when it comes down to security, and they do it really well. These guys truly care about what they are putting out. And the owner, Doug Carter is his name, is one of these people that really cares about who he is protecting, who he is serving, and he takes it really seriously. The big difference is their training. It's incredible. They actually have probably more training than many police departments. JSD Protective Services. You want to find them at 844-663-3611. That's 844-663-3611. JSDProtectiveServices.com. If you could see me right now, you would know that I have on my Blue Lives Matter t-shirt. And this is a t-shirt that always gets comments. It always gets attention. And Warrior12.com is the company that provides all of our t-shirts, all of our clothing line for Blue Lives Matter. And they are badass, I must say. So if you want a very cool t-shirt, hopefully you'll look as cool in it as I do, I would go to Warrior12.com and check out the full line of clothing that they have. And you can also see a lot of it on BlueLivesMatter.blue. Perhaps I have saved the best for last. I don't know if you caught the episode of 60 Minutes that aired earlier this week. 60 Minutes had an interview with one of the true victims of the social movement, the social justice warriors, and the insanity that has embraced this country in the aftermath of the Michael Brown debacle and Ferguson and Baltimore insanity. Her name is Betty Shelby. She served with distinction in the Tulsa Police Department. Her life was one of service, one of community, one of believing in what the badge stands for. She served for years with the Tulsa Police Department. And then one day, she was on patrol. She was answering a domestic violence call. And as she was headed to the domestic violence call, she made an observation of a man who was standing on the side of a roadway, a fairly well-traveled but rural roadway, just standing there with his head on his chest in the middle of nowhere. But because she was on a call, she didn't have time to check him out. She finished with her call, she came back, and she saw a SUV stopped in the middle of the road and no one around it. So she did what a good cop would do. This is exactly what police officers are called to do. Oh, investigate. So here's this SUV in the middle of the road, no one around it. As she gets out, she notices that the windows are down and the car is running. And then she sees the same guy that she had observed driving past just earlier, the guy who was standing there with his head on his chest, seeming to be asleep, walking towards her. She engages him in conversation. Is that your car? And the guy doesn't respond in any coherent fashion. And she, making these observations, he's a very large frame man. He's well over 6 feet, 250, 60 pounds. He's three times the size of this diminutive police officer. She believes him to be under the influence of PCP, which, by the way, it was later determined he was under the influence of PCP. She attempts to control him. She calls for a backup because he's not listening to her. She has every right to tell this individual, while she's conducting this investigation, to stand still so she can pat him down for weapons, so she can investigate what is going on with the car, so she can conduct what a police investigation is. She has every right to do that, but he doesn't listen to her. He's acting bizarrely. She's calling for a backup. Now, here's what's a couple things are taking place at the same time. The police helicopter gets above her and is watching and reporting what's going on. And in some weird coincidence, her husband, who's also a police officer, is the observer in that helicopter. So he's looking down at her while she is trying to deal with this non-compliant suspect. Another cop gets there. And as he gets there, he sees this suspect. His name is Terrence Crutcher, by the way. Crutcher begins walking away from the police officers towards the vehicle. All right, now she has to control him. A, she can't let him get into that car and drive away because she believes him to be under the influence. B, he may very well have a weapon in that car. Now, he acts very bizarrely, but what he does do is he puts his hands up in the air, and then he completely doesn't listen to anything she says. He ignores her and continues to walk towards the open window of the SUV. She's screaming at him, "Stop, stop, get on the ground." And he's not listening. And she has to make the life and death decision of her career. As he gets to the driver's door area of the SUV, he begins leaning towards the open window. Now, she has her weapon out. Her partner, her backup officer, has his taser out because that's the way cops are trained. One officer uses less than lethal force, and another uses lethal force to threaten and to be prepared for a threat. At the very moment that he begins to lean into the car, she fires and kills him. He hits the ground. The helicopter is flying above. The other officer deployed his taser at exactly the same moment she opened fire. Both felt the threat. One officer had non-lethal force or less than lethal force with the taser, and she opened fire with her lethal force, believing that this subject was going for a weapon in the car. Terrence Crutcher did not have a weapon in the car. He was black. She was white. Do I need to tell you where this story went? The outcry was immediate, and because of other situations where white police officers opened fire on quote unarmed, unquote, black suspects, the social pressure on the chief of the Tulsa Police Department and the district attorney was immense. The outcry was immediate. The cries for prosecution were loud and stifling. And even before the Tulsa Police Department completed their investigation, the district attorney, some spineless weasel named Steve Kunzweiler, charged her with first-degree manslaughter and arrested her. Now, let me explain the way it works with police departments. When she was charged criminally, she was no longer under the protection of her contract, her union contract, to represent her for any legal issues. She's now on her own. She's thrown to the wolves. She's thrown under the bus. The rest of the story is that the homicide investigator later said there was no evidence. She should not be charged, but that didn't stop the district attorney from moving on the charges. And the outcry that this murderous police officer killed a poor unarmed black man was resounding and resonating all over the country. Well, this week, Betty Shelby appeared on 60 Minutes in a very unusual interview. I don't think I've ever seen where a police officer gives a media interview of this nature before a jury trial, because she's going to jury trial very shortly. And she was so desperate to get people to listen to her side, which has been completely unheard. She was so desperate that she agreed to do this interview. I'm shocked that her lawyer allowed it, but I think out of desperation they did. They know that the railroad is already taking place. They're already trying to bury her. They're already trying to sacrifice her on the altar of political correctness. And all you heard in this interview, not from her, but from the other people who were interviewed by 60 Minutes, is what a fine, upstanding father Terrence Crutcher was. They didn't say anything about the fact that he was an ex-felon for dealing dope. They didn't say anything about the fact that he was under the influence of PCP. They didn't say anything negative, because if that wouldn't be in the narrative. What they did do is they showed him singing karaoke and hanging out with his family and making him seem like he was the victim. Well, there's a few other things that I have an unnamed source that has to remain anonymous. They didn't mention a few other things in this interview. And that is that, the homicide sergeant, he didn't even have his report finished. And he said that it's highly unusual for the district attorney's office to file charges without his completed report. That's the first time in his career he's ever seen it happen. And there were some other incidents that took place earlier in that week where Terrence Crutcher was seen to be under the influence of PCP and acting criminally. But none of that is being told to the public. To throw this officer under the bus within days of this shooting without an investigation being completed is an injustice. I pray that there is justice for Betty Shelby, because if there isn't, there will be no justice for the American law enforcement officer in this nation. This week's episode of the Interview Room on Police Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, I have with me a very special guest, Heather McDonald. And Heather's bio is amazing. I'm just going to read a little bit of it. It's she's the Thomas W. Smith Fellow at the Manhattan Institute, a contributing editor of City Journal. She's a recipient of the 2005 Bradley Prize. And her work at City Journal has canvassed a range of topics, including higher education, immigration, policing and racial profiling, homelessness, homeless advocacy, criminal justice reform, and race relations. Her writing has appeared in the Wall Street Journal, the Washington Post, New York Times, LA Times, New Republic, New Criterion. But her newest book, The War on Cops, which recently came out, warns that race-based attacks on the criminal justice system from the White House on down are eroding the authority of law and putting lives at risk. Heather, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Randy, thank you so much for having me on. It's a great honor.
You know, I think in light of even what has happened today in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, we are seeing once again playing out on the national stage the results of the Ferguson effect, as it's been called, and what has taken place in law enforcement. What are your thoughts on what's taking place today down there?
Well, certainly a rush to judgment. We don't know all the facts yet. You know, there was a call with a man with a gun threatening people. So officers are going on a gun run, and according to one reading of the video, bystanders confirmed that that the man that was shot had a gun, and the officers too thought he had a gun. So he was not compliant. Obviously, any time that there's a gun involved, an officer has to be concerned about his own life and that of bystanders. But we do need more facts. There's just an immediate assumption that this was a race-based shooting, which, when, of course, it has nothing to do with race.
Right.
This was not somebody that was singled out by the volition of officers. They were called to the scene by a 911 caller. And it just is not the case that officers are quicker to shoot black men. A recent study by Lois James shows that, in fact, in simulator studies, that officers hesitate longer to shoot armed black suspects than white suspects.
Exactly. That, but we can't let the facts get in the way of a good political narrative, though, right?
Well, right. I mean, there's at this point, the media is just completely committed to the Black Lives Matter myth that there's a war on black men on the part of the police.
And what we have seen today, in regards to the shooting in Baton Rouge, something that I haven't seen before is that the Department of Justice has just literally swooped in and taken the investigation away from the district attorney, from the police department, and everyone, and has pressured them not even to run a concurrent investigation. I've never heard of that. Have you?
I can't say one way or another. You know, it sounds like the local law enforcement authorities are welcoming this. It may be that they don't want the pressure on them. I mean, this just becomes so immediately politicized. But I can't say for sure that that has not happened before.
Right, right. Well, you know, what spurred your interest so much with regard to the book that you just wrote, The War on Cops? Where did your passion for this subject come from?
Well, it was actually a sort of, for me, a media issue. The New York Times, after the horrible shooting of Amadou Diallo in New York City by the four NYPD street crime unit officers — Amadou Diallo was the West Ghanaian immigrant who was shot 41 times, and this became a huge cause célèbre. You had Al Sharpton organizing daily arrest-ins at the police headquarters downtown. The New York Times, after that, was running 3.5 articles a day on how this shooting was emblematic of the New York Police Department's war on blacks, and was a function of what the New York Times thought was the out-of-control street crime unit that was making too many pedestrian stops. And given my skepticism about the New York Times, I was just wondering, is that really true? Is the Diallo case emblematic of the NYPD? And what I found was that, in fact, officer use of force in the New York Police Department was at its lowest level ever. I think in 1999 there were 8 or 9 fatal police shootings, which is very low in a department that at that point was about 40,000 officers. And I went out to the community where Diallo was shot, the Soundview section of the Bronx, and I talked to people, and I found a great amount of support for the cops. And that was something that is never reported in any kind of media stories, and certainly not in the New York Times. So it put me on the lookout for the fact that there's a media narrative about policing that may be completely contrary to what the facts are on the ground. And the more I looked at it, the more I found. And what really drove me was both the unfairness to police officers of this immediate, simplistic conceit that they are racist for going after criminals in minority neighborhoods, but also the fact that so many law-abiding minority residents of inner-city communities supported the cops, wanted more policing, and they're just never recognized.
Yes, right. I understand exactly what you're saying. So you went through, you lived through the way that New York City changed under Rudy Giuliani. In fact, I guess you were part of that change, were you not?
Well, I certainly was observing it, but I didn't. I was a big believer in broken windows policing and the CompStat revolution, the data-driven revolution that spread nationwide. So I don't know if you're referring to Giuliani gave me a very nice blurb at the back of the book. I think it was overly generous, but certainly I'm a very big supporter of how proactive policing is really the most successful government program for urban revitalization and economic revitalization in high crime areas.
And the now you have seen kind of a reversal of those policies taking place in New York City, and you're seeing the once again that it's almost a complete dichotomy under the de Blasio administration, basically saying that the broken windows theory is racist and ineffective.
Yeah, de Blasio has a very, very troubled and unfortunate relationship with the NYPD. After the Eric Garner grand jury, the man who was taken down, was resisting arrest, but in a rather mild form, was taken down and eventually died. He was a large man with asthma and obese. And the grand jury, presented with the evidence, decided not to indict the officer who took him down for homicide. De Blasio grandstanded and said that the case and the verdict, the no true bill indictment, represented centuries of racism. In other words, accusing the NYPD of being the embodiment of racism, and said that he worried every night about his son, whether he'd come home at night because of the NYPD. This was simply ridiculous. The chance of a black male in New York City being shot by a police officer is minuscule. Again, the number of fatal police shootings run to about under 10 a year, whereas there's still hundreds of shootings in New York City, and blacks commit between 75 and 80% of all shootings, even though they're only 23% of the population. So Mayor de Blasio's son, Dante, is at far, far greater risk from getting shot by a black criminal than he is from a police officer.
Right. And it's under de Blasio, they have changed actually ended stop and frisk and many of the proactive policing methods that were employed that really diminished the crime statistics demonstrably during the Giuliani era.
Well, I think Chicago is really the best example of what I've called the Ferguson effect, because you have stops there down about 90%. And shootings are just absolutely through the roof. I mean, it's a 50% increase in shootings this year. Several weekends ago, someone was shot every 43 minutes, including a 3-year-old boy who was shot and is now paralyzed for life. And so in city after city, you do see when cops back off of proactive policing, crime goes through the roof. New York City, in the first half of 2015, homicides were up about 20%, and it consistent with what was happening in the rest of the country with the Ferguson effect. And de Blasio, the mayor, and William Bratton, the police commissioner on his second tour of duty in New York, were clearly freaking out. And because de Blasio knows that any mayor will not get reelected if he does not hold crime down. So what Bratton did was get his hands on every officer he could and deploy them in crime hotspots just to stand around and use command presence as opposed to actually be proactive and make stops. And that has put a ceiling on the crime increase that was so worrisome in the first half of 2015. So we ended 2015 with a 6% increase in homicide, which is much less than some of the other cities. So despite de Blasio's anti-cop rhetoric and the fall off in stops there, we have not had the same really horrific consequences as other cities because of the NYPD's enormous size and the fact that there's just Bratton or any other commissioner has the ability to just throw bodies at a problem.
Right, exactly. And I don't think Chicago has that option. Between what's going on politically up there with the last removal of the police chief, they seem to be completely out of control. And it really is because of the depolicing effect that we have been seeing.
Oh, absolutely. And officers in Chicago say the job has become basically undoable. One officer told me that he hasn't seen such hatred on the streets in his 20 years as a police officer. You know, this is true across the country, again, that officers are reluctant to get out of their car and make a pedestrian stop or enforce a low-level broken window type offense when they don't have to. It's purely discretionary because the situation that they encounter can be just so virulent and angry and hostile.
Right. The old adage, you'll never get in trouble for the car stop you don't make, comes to mind.
Right, exactly.
And I too am hearing that from police officers in all over the country. I mean, not even just in the big cities, but this is affecting law enforcement officers in small towns as well.
Yeah, I coined the term nationally, the Ferguson effect, picking up on St. Louis Police Chief Sam Dotson first used it to describe what was happening in St. Louis. It was when I first wrote about this. This was enormously controversial, and it's still just anathema, especially in criminology circles, to recognize the connection between depolicing and crime increases, and to acknowledge that officers are backing off. But I have a hard time talking to a cop who will not say that he is second-guessing himself these days. Now, what's interesting is that there's some people in the higher ranks, like Daryl Steffens of the Major City Chiefs Association, that also are Ferguson effect deniers, as I call them.
Right.
And I think they are so worried that somebody's going to misinterpret it and say, oh, the cops are lazy or they're not doing their jobs. But what they're not doing is the discretionary policing. And they, of course, are running to 911 calls with, you know, as much speed as they can possibly muster. But that's not how you bring crime down. You know, after there's already been a victim, yes, you have to get there, but that's not the way you lower crime. But it's interesting to me that many sort of highly political police figures count themselves among the Ferguson effect deniers.
I find that very interesting as well. In fact, President Obama himself is a Ferguson effect denier. And was during a press interview with the FBI director who contradicted him. That wound up making national news as well.
Yeah, I mean FBI Director James Comey speaks to police officers, and in an October speech at the University of Chicago Law School, Comey warned of what he called the chill wind blowing through law enforcement and said officers tell him, you know, they just don't want to get out of their car because they're so immediately surrounded by people sticking cell phones in their faces. A few days after Comey made that speech, and Comey also connected that to the crime increases that he was seeing in the 50 largest cities, and that speech, I just, as an aside, it has a fantastic rebuttal of the idea that we are engaged in mass incarceration. Comey spoke about the incredible transformative power of the Richmond Weed and Seed Program taking out drug dealers and said everybody that's in prison today received full due process of the law. He was individually prosecuted. There was nothing mass about it. But after Comey made this speech warning of the Ferguson effect, Obama, several days later, accused him of cherry-picking data and having a political agenda. 2 months ago, Comey again brought it up and said he's even more worried because the crime increase is continuing. And at that point, Josh Earnest, the White House press secretary, again accused him of not having the facts. Well, this is ludicrous. There's no way that Josh Earnest or President Obama know more about crime and policing and what's happening on the streets than the FBI director, but it is simply unacceptable for the anti-cop left to recognize the connection between proactive policing and crime.
Exactly, exactly. You know, and I think that we are just now beginning to see the effects of this. I think there are going to be some very disturbing long-term effects to this as well, especially when it comes to retention of officers and recruitment.
Oh, absolutely. The police chief of Pasadena, California, told me that it's not an applicant pool anymore. It's an applicant trickle. Why would anybody want to go into the profession now when they are tarred before they do anything with the label of being a racist, and when they know that their use of force is going to be unfairly scrutinized through a racial lens? And, you know, officers continue to believe in the good people in the community who support them, but they're no match for a media and political elite that are just deeply committed to this narrative of racist cops preying out of just virulence on minority communities.
I think that's probably affecting the emotional well-being and the psychological well-being of police officers as well.
Oh, sure. Absolutely. It's just enormous pressure. They face enormous pressure enough as it is. Having to see a reality that the rest of the country refuses to acknowledge, which is inner city breakdown. Officers working in high crime, underclass, inner city neighborhoods are called on these domestic violence calls and just see squalor, parental irresponsibility, and the rest of the country turns its eyes away from that. And officers are the only ones who have to deal with it and bear that knowledge, and that's stress enough. But now to know that you're going to be second-guessed and that your efforts to bring peace are not going to be understood, it just must be just an enormous burden.
You know, I had a recent conversation with Dr. Kevin Gilmartin, who wrote the book Emotional Survival for Law Enforcement, and he himself was a 25-year veteran, a police officer. And during this conversation, he said that he's never seen a situation regarding the emotional well-being of law enforcement officers under attack in such a tremendous fashion.
Mm-hmm. No, it's just unprecedented. You know, you had it in the 60s when you had radical groups like the Weather Underground and the Black Panthers using anti-cop rhetoric off the pigs and in fact, killing cops. But they were the fringe. They were not in league with the establishment.
Right.
Except maybe covertly, but really, I think you still had a lot of support for law enforcement. But today, the Black Lives Matter movement, which traffics in lies about law enforcement, is supported by the establishment. Harvard University's president, Drew Gilpin Faust, gave a nauseating speech in 2015 about, or actually it was 2014, I guess, right? It was before the assassination of two New York police officers. And she was basically saying we still live with this huge racial injustice for which she was blaming the police. This is remarkable, absolutely remarkable. She knows nothing about policing. You have Obama echoing the claim that officers treat similarly situated whites and blacks differently. So it is a completely changed environment from the 1960s.
Well, I mean, you don't have to look far in the past to even see the Democratic debates where they were all asked, do all lives matter or do black lives matter? And to,
right.
And to a person, they said black lives matter.
Right. I know. And there's now some city councilmen in Chicago who are wanting to pass a Blue Lives Matter bill that would add police officers to the list of protected victims for hate crimes. And the opposition to that is really quite extraordinary, you know, that how police officers can never be victims of hate crimes. They're the oppressors. And this would silence protest and free speech. No, it's just saying that if you injure, commit a crime against an officer, we're going to, you know, look at that differently. Now, I'm not necessarily in favor of hate crime laws generally, but if we've got them, let's not pretend that there are not specific designated groups that may in fact be the target of hate crimes. But in fact, the very idea of saying Blue Lives Matter is just anathema to the ACLU and some of these anti-cop activist groups.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, they recently passed that the Blue Lives Matter law down in Louisiana, as a matter of fact.
That's right.
And I don't know if you're aware of this. I don't think I told you this when we were speaking, but I'm the national spokesman for Blue Lives Matter.
Good.
And right. Great. Now, but you know, it's interesting. We're seeing something else on the other side of the pendulum, and that is that police support groups are springing up in a way that I've never seen before. And if you just take Blue Lives Matter just as a singular support group, our following now has pretty close to 800,000 people. And
that's wonderful.
It's amazing, but we would never have seen that had we not seen the opposite.
Right, absolutely. But it's too bad that you need it.
Yeah, it is. Well, how
do you... it's too bad. I mean, Trump should be able to leverage this. Occasionally he talked about the silent majority supporting the police, but I just don't think he's informed enough about any topic to really grasp what's going on. But I think you're right that he's right that there still is a silent majority supporting cops, but they just have no spokesman at this point.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, it's interesting you say that because I just last week had a full day meeting with his chief policy advisor about just this very topic, about the topic of policing.
Oh, fabulous. Well, that's good to know. But, you know, whether that gets into his head is another question.
Exactly. That's exactly right. Well, let me ask you this. You know, you're so well informed and you've done such tremendous research. Do you see any light at the end of the tunnel? Or are we going to continue this hatefulness and this, increasing violence towards the police?
I'm a pessimist by nature, so you've got to factor that in. But I do not see a light at the end of the tunnel, especially if Hillary Clinton is elected, because she has been making it perfectly clear that she intends to demagogue even beyond President Obama against the criminal justice system, against the police. And it is this new era of the cell phone video, which is why I support police cameras, because they're going to vindicate officers far more than they'll inculpate them.
Right.
But it's just an extremely costly solution to what I view largely as a non-problem. But it's impossible to overstate the extent to which the university culture is a generator of Black Lives Matter type ideology, and they show no signs of backing down. So you've got just an unholy alliance between the media, the activists, the universities, and political establishment.
Unfortunately, I couldn't agree with you more. You know, before we go, tell us a little bit more about your recent book, The War on Cops.
Well, it's a refutation of the multiple lies of the Black Lives Matter movement. It gives the real facts on police shootings and race. It gives the facts on incarceration. The fact remains that prison remains a lifetime achievement award for persistence in criminal offending. It gives voice to the people who support the police, and it takes down the whole anti-cop narrative, I think, with data research.
And I think that's something that probably law enforcement officers and their supporters should really arm themselves with that knowledge. What's in the future? What's your next project?
Well, for now, there's certainly, unfortunately, so much policing in the news still. So that, but I also write about a lot about academic culture, and but I'm actually researching something on this whole implicit bias concept. I attended a DOJ-sponsored implicit bias train, the trainers meeting in the suburbs of St. Louis.
That must have been
in
interesting.
The spring. Well, it was more anodyne than I expected. I thought it would be worse. It was sort of innocuous, frankly, but the research behind it is certainly questionable. And again, the best study that just come out, the Lois James study, shows that officers are slower to shoot armed black suspects than armed white suspects. So that kind of throws everything that this whole implicit bias movement is doing into disarray, but it's going to, that which will, of course, will not stop it.
Of course it won't. Now, your book can be purchased on Amazon and Barnes & Noble and local bookstores?
Sure, absolutely, Randy. I local bookstores, and if people don't want to go to their local bookstore, on the web.
That's perfect. You know, I really appreciate you taking the time to spend some time with my listening audience, and I really applaud the work that you're doing.
End of watch.
Each week on Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement, we honor those men and women who have given their lives in the line of duty. This week, I have three names to read for End of Watch. The first is Master Sergeant Carl T. Cosper of the Barry County Sheriff's Office in Missouri. Master Sergeant Carl Cosper was killed in a vehicle collision while responding to a domestic violence call in the town of Seligman. He was traveling south on Missouri 37 at County Road 1060, approximately 1/2 mile south of the city of Washburn, when his patrol car struck a school bus that turned left in front of him. His patrol car overturned. He was ejected from the vehicle. Sergeant Cosper was taken to a local hospital where he succumbed to his injuries. Master Sergeant Carl T. Cosper, End of Watch, April 7th, 2017. The second law enforcement officer to give his life in the line of duty this week was Deputy Sheriff Levi Petaway of the Lowndes County Sheriff's Office in Alabama. Deputy Sheriff Levi Petaway was killed in a single vehicle crash on Alabama 21 in Haynesville. Deputy Petaway's patrol car left the roadway and struck several trees. Rescue crews extricated him from the vehicle, but were unable to revive him. Deputy Petaway had served with the Lowndes County Sheriff's Office for 12 years and was assigned as a school resource officer at the Calhoun School. He survived by his wife. Lowndes County Sheriff's Office Deputy Sheriff Levi Petaway, End of Watch, Monday, April 10th, 2017. The third law enforcement officer to give his life in the line of duty this week was Wisconsin State Patrol Trooper Anthony J. Baratowski of the Wisconsin State Patrol. Trooper Anthony Baratowski was killed in a single vehicle crash at mile marker 89 on I-90-94 near Wisconsin Dells. He was on patrol at approximately 4 a.m. when his patrol car left the road and struck a tree. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Wisconsin State Highway Patrol Officer Anthony Borotowski. His end of watch, Tuesday, April 11th, 2017. These officers all gave their lives in the line of duty. May they rest in peace. I want to thank you for tuning in this week to this episode of Blue Lives Radio, the voice of American law enforcement on the America Out Loud Network.